This is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. One of the most notable and quoted books of the century is a red and white plaid-covered schoolgirl's diary with the flimsy, fractured lock. It was gotten as a birthday gift by a 13-year-old girl in the summer of 1942 who pasted a class portrait of herself on the inside cover and wrote,
"Gorgeous photograph, isn't it?"
Then set down an inscription on the first page in careful, cursive letters.
"I hope I shall be able to confide in you completely, as I have never been able to do in anyone before, and hope that you will be a great support and comfort to me."
A classmate of Anne Frank's in the Jewish School of Amsterdam, Hanalie Pick Goslar, remembers her friend carrying that plaid-covered diary between classes, then peeling back the pages to write.
"And everybody would ask, 'What are you writing?' And she would say, 'Oh, that's none of your business.'"
But Anne Frank's diary has become one of the most enduring documents of the century in which mechanized mass murder was invented. Anne Frank of Amsterdam died about this date 50 years ago. The exact day is unknown. She died in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in central Germany. About 106,000 Dutch Jews were killed during that crime that's become known as the Holocaust. 1 million Jews in the Soviet Union, 3 million in Poland, 6 million throughout German-occupied Europe. Many of the millions of names have been memorialized in stone and stained glass. Many are still commemorated in prayers. But Vincent Frank Steiner, president of the Anne Frank Foundation in Basel, Switzerland, points out,
"Killing millions of people, that's an abstract thing. But the only person which is known everywhere, which has been killed in German concentration camps, is Anne Frank."
Anne Frank's own true story, set down in her own words, has become the chronicle by which millions of people throughout the world are taught and reminded that hate kills. Her diary is taught to schoolchildren in Europe and North America, India, South Africa, and Japan. Words written by Anne Frank are engraved onto a stone panel at United Nations headquarters in New York City. The same words, copied by hand by Otto Frank, Anne's father, are framed near Mother Teresa's straw cot at her home for the dying and destitute in Calcutta. The book was considered dangerous enough to be banned in South Africa until 1982, but Nelson Mandela says prisoners smuggled copies into the Robben Island prison. It has also been banned from some school districts here in the United States, burned by neo-Nazi groups who doubt the Holocaust, and disbelieved by less treacherous skeptics who simply wonder if a girl just 15 when she died could truly write with such vividness and wit, power and grace. We asked young people in several places who were the same ages as Anne Frank when she wrote her diary to read passages from her book, The Diary of a Young Girl. The first entry describes her birthday, the day she received the diary, whom she addresses as a friend she calls Kitty.
"Soon after 7, I went to Mummy and Daddy, and then to the sitting room to undo my presents. The first to greet me was you, possibly the nicest of all."
She confides in this first entry that she wants to be a writer. She also says that she awakened early, played with the family cat, saw roses on the breakfast table, and unwrapped chocolates, puzzles, and books before her friend Lise, Hanalie Pick Goslar, came by.
"My mother always used to say, 'God knows everything. Anne knows everything better.'" This describes it very nicely. She was a very, in America, I think you say, spicy girl.
Yeah.
She was very special, you know.
Hanalie Pick Goslar, of course, can remember when her friend was a bookish, boisterous little girl, not yet a symbol.
"Then she had something I never saw, not before and not later on. She could take out her shoulder out of the socket." Hello?
Yes,
And then she put it back. And everybody was looking. You know, that's very unhealthy to do, and you can't end up with an orthopedic doctor.
Yeah.
But she liked it, and then she liked most everybody to look at her.
Oh, my.
It would go knack, knack, you know, you would hear it. You would see it, but you would hear it.
I thought it was going to begin with, gloom, and she was going to be in the concentration camp already, and that she would be telling us about her circumstances. I didn't know, actually, that she had a life before the concentration camp.
Young people in Washington, D.C., who put out the syndicated column Children's Express, talked with us about the diary.
When I open it up, it's like Hold up. I don't see a tragedy life. I see the perfect family, a girl that's happy and things like that. I mean, she even has a cat. And, you know, she gets roses for her birthday and things like that.
But as I read on, I realized that the change in her life happened so quickly, and it must have been so difficult for her to adjust from a good life with roses and cats and little biscuits to tragic life.
The Frank family was from Frankfurt, Germany. Anne was born there in 1929. Her sister Margot was 3.5 years older. Otto Frank had seen the rise of Adolf Hitler and the National Socialists, the Nazis, and their undisguised anti-Semitism as a personal warning. Jews could not be safe in Germany. So in 1933, as Hitler became chancellor, Mr. Frank and his wife Edith moved their family to Amsterdam to open a small branch office for a company that sold pectin, a fruit powder used to thicken jams. Anne grew up in Amsterdam and considered herself Dutch, proudly an Amsterdammer. She loved strolling by the cafes, the art and bookstores lining the city's gentle gray canals. "These kindly, tolerant people who have given us a home," she once wrote. But the German army overwhelmed Holland in just 5 days in 1940. Anne wrote that by 1942 the Germans had brought their race laws to her kindly, tolerant city.
"Jews must wear a yellow star. Jews must hand in their bicycles. Jews are banned from trams and are forbidden to drive. Jews are only allowed to do their shopping between 3 and 5 o'clock, and then only in shops which bear the placard, Jewish Shop. Jews must be indoors by 8 o'clock and cannot even sit on their own gardens after that hour. Jews are forbidden to visit theaters, cinemas, and other places of entertainment."
I mean, I don't think it's possible, but it seems so, unhumanitarian in how... So wild that you have to be branded a certain thing. You have to walk around with a star on your clothes that says what you are.
But even though we say that it's impossible that this ever happened or no one would live like that, you see that in Bosnia, you know, when we had the big crisis and just all around the world with the religious cleansing and stuff.
It happened here in America when there was segregation among mm-hmm. blacks and whites, and it was pretty much the same. History repeats itself.
Otto Frank prepared once more to find a refuge for his family. Over a year's time, he cleared out the top floor storage space at his business. Two friends in his office, Johannes Kleiman and Miep Gies, hinged a bookcase over an opening leading into stairs that rose into four small, forgotten rooms. Mr. Frank told Anne, "We will leave before the Germans can haul us away." Just 3 days later, July 8, 1942, Anne's sister Margot turned 16 and received a summons to report to the Westborg Deportation Center, from which she would be sent to a work camp. So that night, the Frank sisters packed. To avoid the suspicion of carrying suitcases, they fitted what they could into their school bags.
"The first thing I put in was this diary, then hair curlers, handkerchiefs, school books, a comb, and old letters. I put in the craziest things with the idea that we were going into hiding. But I'm not sorry. Memories mean more to me than dresses."
Were they the craziest things?
No.
No. They were necessities to me because, I mean, curlers I need. I mean, and school books and things like that. I mean, you need those things. I mean, like for school, for education, mm-hmm. to open your mind to different things. And back then, she probably thought those are little things, but later in life, she really found out that those were probably some of the most important things that she needed, mm-hmm. you know?
I think that sort of shows her optimism again. It's like, you know, I'll make it out, and I'll be able to use these things again to curl my hair for another photo for another time.
Franks took their cat to a neighbor's that night and scrawled out a flurry of notes hinting that they had escaped to Switzerland. Early the next morning, each family member pulled on three sets of clothes and walked about 20 blocks in a clammy July rain to the office at 263 Prinzengracht. They walked because Jews were forbidden to ride the trams. Before the building opened for business, They climbed up to what Anne came to call their secret annex. M.T. De Silva of the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam showed us the hinged bookcase which hid the entrance.
And when one of the helpers of the family Frank wanted to go inside, they had a special knock on the door, and then the family Frank opened the bookcase. And you can open it now, and then we enter the annex.
Eight people came to live there, the four Franks, Herman and August Van Pels, and their son Peter, whom Anne calls the Van Dams in her diary, and a single man, a dentist, Fritz Pfeffer, whom Anne writes about as Mr. Dussel. When we sat with M.T. De Silva on the ground floor of the Anne Frank house, you could clearly hear the coughs and the footsteps of tourists walking in the secret annex upstairs. The wooden building still creaks like an old ship under each step.
Yeah, you can hear them quite loudly. Yeah, they had to remain quiet the whole day from 8:30 until 5:30 in the afternoon. And they had 1 hour lunch time when they could go to the toilets or wash their hands or walk around. But that was only 1 hour during the whole day.
Anne wrote repeatedly of the challenge to be silent.
We are quiet as baby mice. Who 3 months ago could have guessed that Quicksilver Anne would have to sit still for hours? And what's more, could.
Well, personally, I couldn't bear it, like, living the life that I've lived now. I really couldn't do it. It really does make you sick to your stomach to hear things like that, that she couldn't be out having fun or enjoying her life. She had to be sitting there like a statue so that she wouldn't get in trouble, like, killed or jail or anything like that, you know?
I think it's kind of like when you're little and you play hide-and-go-seek and you find the best hiding place. And you have to sit there for so long and be so quiet. Because if you move, then everybody will find you in this great hiding place.
Miep Gies, who is now 81 and still lives in Amsterdam, helped to hide them. She was one of six people who worked in Mr. Frank's office and a family friend. She loathed fascism and risked her life for the Franks and the Van Pels. At lunch hour, when the office emptied, Miep Gies would bring food and news upstairs. The food was often meager and the news bad.
In a way, it was a bit painful to me. Mm-hmm. And to see them standing in a line at the top of the stairs, waiting for me to begin. It showed their dependence on us, the helpers. It was often Anne who could break the silence, asking, "Hallo, Mimp, and what is the matter?"
Wij hier kunnen maar uit de verte benaderen wat u nu doormaakt.
Early in 1944, Anne heard Radio Orange from the exiled Dutch government in London call on Hollanders to keep letters and diaries documenting their time under German occupation. And with this call, Anne Frank became a deliberate and a serious writer, not only recording entries in her diary several times a week, but rewriting passages from the months before, also writing sketches and satires to amuse her companions in the annex. Once she described their hiding place in the parlance of an apartment ad.
Board and lodging, free. Special fat-free diet. Running water in the bathrooms. Alas, no bath. And down various inside and outside walls. Use of language. Speak softly at all times by order. All civilized languages are permitted. Therefore, no German.
In the compulsory quiet of the secret annex, Anne's diary became an outlet for her laughter, and of revealing, if only to herself, the depths of her sadness. She said it was sometimes hard for her when one of their helpers came to the secret annex.
With the wind in their clothes and the cold on their faces, then I could bury my head in the blankets to stop myself thinking, when will we be granted the privilege of smelling fresh air? I don't know, and I couldn't talk about it to anyone, because then I know I should cry. Crying can bring such relief.
Anne arranged her own vistas on the walls of the shuttered room that she shared with Fritz Pfeffer. She pasted up magazine pictures, Rema Land, Coco Chanel, the young princesses Anne and Margaret of England, Holland's exiled Prince Bernard in his Royal Air Force uniform, and Diana Durbin. She glued two Rembrandt prints near the dark curtains drawn tight across the windows, one of a winding Amsterdam canal, another of a Renaissance wedding. M.T. De Silva explains.
Of course, there were thick curtains for the room because they couldn't see, they couldn't look outside. But sometimes she could see the oak tree. And, well, we have a few now. We have a few there on the oak tree.
She just parted the windows very slightly.
Yes, yes. And the oak tree, yeah, it was a symbol of freedom.
From peeking through flaps in the blackout curtains, listening to Radio Orange at night, and talking to Johannes Kleiman and Miep Geese during the day, Anne pieced together a picture of her city outside, November 19, 1943.
Evening after evening, the green and gray army lorries trundle past. The Germans ring at every front door to inquire if there are any Jews living in the house. It seems like the slave hunts of olden times. No one is spared, old people, babies, expectant mothers, the sick. Each and all join in the march of death.
I feel wicked sleeping in a warm bed, while my dearest friends have been knocked down or have fallen into a gutter somewhere out in the cold night. I feel frightened when I think of those close friends who have now been delivered into the hands of the cruelest brutes that walk the earth, and all because they are Jews. Yours, Anne.
Radio Orange broadcast a parody of Deutschland über alles to cheer about the Allied bombs falling all over Germany.
Alles, alles über Deutschland. Von der Fabrik von Krupp staat alleen noch maar de stoep.
But Anne Frank heard the dim drone of British, American, and Canadian bombers, and then wrote,
"Every night, hundreds of planes fly over Holland and go to German towns, where the earth is plowed up by their bombs, and every hour hundreds and thousands of people are killed in Russia and Africa. No one is able to keep out of it. The whole globe is waging war, and although it's going better for the Allies, the end is not yet in sight.
There is nothing we can do but wait as calmly as we can till the misery comes to an end. Jews and Christians wait. The whole earth waits, and there are many who wait for death. Yours, Anne."
I think it would be very easy for her to not care. And I think that shows what a strong character she is.
At 13, what's the worst problem? I have to worry about getting my homework in time enough to watch like, what, 90210. That's, like, the worst thing in my life right now. And
90210 is the worst thing in your life, I'm sure.
And then, you know, she has to worry about what she's going to eat next. You know, if the Germans are going to come and raid where she's hiding just on no notice, if she's going to live to see the next day.
At a time in her life often given to discovery, Anne Frank found the world she could explore brutally bordered by four walls, blackout curtains, and bare survival. In the emotional congestion of the secret annex, she quarreled with her mother, perhaps even more than usual. She wrote about resenting her sister Margot as prettier, smarter, nicer. And then she turned within to self-discovery. About a year into hiding, Anne Frank wrote that she began to menstruate.
"Each time I have a period, and that has only been 3 times, I have the feeling that in spite of all the pain, unpleasantness, and nastiness, I have a sweet secret, and that is why, although it is nothing but a nuisance to me in a way, I always long for the next time that I shall feel that secret within me again."
The Dutch, it might be said, have historically had fewer compunctions than Americans about such portrayals, but passages like those have gotten Anne's diary banned from several school districts in the United States. A few more passages will be known soon. Just this month, the new unabridged edition is being published, which restores most of the material left out in the early 1950s. Included is Anne's graphic, good-natured description of her private parts. It reads as if she were sketching another secret annex. She also wrote more about the discomforts and animosities she felt with her mother.
"You know that I'm grumbled a lot about Mommy, yet still try to be nice to her again. Now it is suddenly clear to me what she lacks. Mommy herself has told us that she looked upon us as her friends, than her daughters. Now that is all very fine, but still, a friend can't take a mother's place. I need my mother as an example which I can follow.
that was quite sad. And she had this insecurity about herself. She was growing up, I mean, having these feelings of her sexual identity. And then it's like she couldn't even talk to her mother. And it just make you want to just slap her mother in the face and go, wake up, your child is growing up, you need to help her. I mean, it doesn't really make any sense.
Let me try and say a word in behalf of Mrs. Frank, though.
Yeah, but the point was that, she just kind of forgot about her own child, and that wasn't even right. I mean, she never forgot about Margot, but she forgot about her, and it hurt her feelings. I just don't believe that was right.
A mother who, let me as the adult here point out, a mother who gave her life to try and keep her children safe. A mother who did more than most mothers in this world ever have to do.
At one point, she does talk about the fact that she has clearly hurt her mother's feelings. So it's not all to be put on the mother that she doesn't care, that she doesn't want to have a good relationship with Anne, because I think she clearly does. I think just that at the point that they were forced together, mm-hmm. Anne was at kind of a point in her life when she would rather be with friends.
This is London.
In the summer of 1944, the BBC and Radio Orange announced the invasion of Europe and said liberation was at hand. People in the annex began to see an end to their time in hiding behind the bookcase. Anne was exultant, but she also cringed at the further suffering it would surely cost. Meep Geese, the family's principal link to the world outside, got engaged. Anne gave her a present, a short story she wrote about a young girl who possesses two personalities, the good Paula and the bad Paula. She read the story aloud in the annex. The residents thought she was writing about herself. On August 1st, she tells her diary there are two Annes.
Oh, I would like to listen, but it doesn't work. If I'm quiet and serious, everyone thinks it's a new comedy, and then I have to get out of it by turning it into a joke, not to mention my own family, who are sure to think I'm ill, make me swallow pills for headaches and nerves, feel my neck and head to see whether I'm running a temperature, ask if I'm constipated and criticize me for being in a bad mood. I can't keep that up, if I'm watched to that extent. I start by getting snappy, then unhappy. And finally, I twist my heart round again, so that the bad is on the outside and the good is on the inside, and keep on trying to find a way of becoming what I would so like to be and what I could be if there weren't any other people living in the world. Yours, Anne.
That was the last entry in Anne Frank's diary. Someone, to this day, it's never been determined who, betrayed the people in the secret annex. Just 3 mornings after Anne Frank wrote those words, 2 German SS officers and 3 Dutch accomplices burst into the ground floor of 263 Prinsengracht, pushing past Meep Geese and Johannes Klamer with shouts and shaking their revolvers. Meep Geese recalls that they even knew to pull back the bookcase.
I also remember the words of Mr. Klamer. Meep, it is over now.
The men came into the attic and overturned crates and chairs, shaking out Anne, Margot, and Peter Van Pelt's school bags, looking for money or jewels. They kept what few they found. How long have you been here? They shouted. Otto Frank told them 25 months, and when they laughed, he showed them pencil marks he'd made on a wall to mark Anne's rising height. Mr. Frank then offered them money, although he had none they hadn't found, to turn away, to shut the door, to forget about the secret annex. But according to the Dutch War Crimes Commission, SS Sergeant Carl Silbauer replied, "It is too late for this." The people in the attic and Johannes Klamen were taken away. Later that afternoon, Meep Geese crept back up into their hiding place.
Then I saw Anne's diary scattered all over the floor. I took this with me for 2 reasons. First, I did not want it to be read by the police because it could contain dangerous information that could harm us or others. In the second place, I hoped I could return to Anne after the war. I wanted to see her smile and hear her say, "Oh, Meep, my diary." I did not read the diary till after the war. I was afraid
of more pain.
The eight people who had been hiding in the annex were taken to a transit camp, and within a month to Auschwitz, the concentration camp in Poland. Hermann and August von Pelz were gassed to death there. Peter was marched to death on a work detail. He was 16. People who remember seeing the Frank sisters and their mother in the women's barracks at Auschwitz say they were constantly together, holding on to one another, at the last moments of their lives, at last at peace with their love for each other. Edith Frank died in the early fall from hunger and disease. As the Third Reich retreated, the Germans determined to kill as many Jews as they could before being defeated. This involved extensive effort and relocation. Otto Frank survived because there were so many people to be killed in the Auschwitz crematorium. His turn never came. Margot and Anne Frank were sent to the Bergen-Belsen camp in Germany. Their coats and eyeglasses were taken. Their heads were shaved. Hannelie Pick-Goslar, Anne's childhood friend, was already a prisoner in Bergen-Belsen. Another Amsterdamer told her, "Your friend Anna is in camp." So she went to a fence by the barracks and called out for her.
And it was dark and it was cold, and I just start to call, hello, hello, something. And so I stood there in the cold at one side of the barbed wire, and after some minutes, Anna came at the other side. And we couldn't see each other. It was dark, but also because there was this straw in between. But we could hear each other, but it was very dangerous, so we had really to whisper. And then she said she's cold and she has no hair. She always liked to curl her hair. Her hair was very important for her. Mm-hmm. So she really mentioned it. I have no hair and I have no clothes. It's cold. And she was really exhausted. And she told me her sister is so sick and I have nobody anymore.
Anne Frank shivered. She coughed. She was sad to her soul.
And so I told her I will try to throw over some food. She should come back after 2 days. And we really met after 2 days at night. And I came with a very small package. Everybody helped me, gave me a sock and a little, how do you say, for your hands?
Gloves?
Yeah, a glove.
Gloves, yeah.
And so, you know, very little package, but it was, when you have nothing, it was a lot. And I throw it over, and I hear that she is crying. And I say, what happened? Said, oh, there were hundreds of hungry women walking there, and I couldn't see exactly where she is. So another woman, she got the package, and she ran away with it, and she didn't give her anything.
Hannelie Pick-Goslar lives today in Jerusalem. In her diary, Anne said she had seen Hannelie in her dreams, brutal nightmares in which Hannelie reached out for Anne and cried out from a death camp.
Oh, Anne, why have you deserted me? Help me, help me, rescue me from this hell.
She says, if only I could help her. Dear God, I have everything I could wish for.
Yeah.
While fate has her in its deadly clutches. What's the difference between us? Why are we now so far apart?
Look, this is one of the reasons that I am speaking about this the whole time. For don't think it is so easy for me always to repeat this.
Yes.
But this is the reason that Anna thought she is alive and I am dead. And now I am alive and she is dead. So I am quite obliged to tell about her because she so much wanted to live after her death. She wanted to be known. And now she is much, much more known than she ever would have dreamed about, yes?
Yeah.
And so I also have to help with this. I think I have to do this. And also because I think we are not allowed to forget this and we have to tell about it.
Another close friend of the Frank Girls in Amsterdam was Hilda Goldberg. She became a translator traveling with British forces who liberated the Bergen-Belsen camp in April of 1945.
And so I asked all the names I could ask about when I saw the Dutch surviving children. And they told me that Mrs. Frank had died in Auschwitz. That was a fact, almost immediately. And that Margot had become sick. And Margot was very nearsighted. She slept in an upper bunk. and she fell out of the bunk and had a concussion and died. And it was bitter cold, of course, and Anne was always wrapped in a blanket and in terrible condition. And somebody had told her, she had hoped that she would at least find her father after the liberation, and somebody had told her that they were sure that her father had died. And so she really gave up and died also. And that's what I was told. And then after liberation, when I had leave to go back to Amsterdam, I met Otto Frank in the street, and he told me what had happened at with my parents, and I told him what I knew about Anna and Margot.
Had he at that point, may I ask, when you ran into him in 1945, still had some hope alive that he would see his daughters again?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. So you were the one who had to tell him.
I was the messenger, right.
Over the years, rumors and whispers have arisen questioning the authenticity of Anne Frank's Diary of a Young Girl. Rumors that Otto Frank, or a New York playwright, or a publishing house editor actually wrote it or extensively rewrote Anne's diary. Those rumors are among the great lies of this century. But they became so persistent that in the early 1980s, the Dutch War Documentation Center tested the diaries left to them by Otto Frank. They dated the ink, the paper, and glue, and analyzed the handwriting, then delivered a legal judgment in 1984. Quote, Anne Frank is the author of her diaries. Vincent Frank Steiner of the Anne Frank Foundation says of the diaries' accusers,
these are the same people who say there have never been concentration camps, no Auschwitz, no gas chambers, so we know from which political corner such rumors, if that word is correct, come from.
The diaries were edited to reduce repetition, focus interest, and increase clarity, but they weren't rewritten. Reading the original translations against the first published Diary of a Young Girl, you were mostly stunned by the fidelity of the book to the manuscript that Anne Frank wrote out by hand in the dim light of her secret annex. Novelist Judy Blume read the diary when she was 12 years old in 1952, when it was first published. She grew up to write best-selling books for teenagers and says, the diary is not only an enduring document, but the achievement of the hope Anne Frank held for herself to become a writer.
Would she ever have written anything as moving, as important as that diary? Maybe. She certainly was a careful observer of life, and she could write. She could put it all there. But I don't know if it ever would have meant as much to the world. She's always going to be 14 on the brink. Here I go. So you can't say, I think, what might she have done, because there isn't any way to know, and instead we should be grateful that she left what she did.
Otto Frank, who died in 1980, was careful to say there not only was an Anne Frank, there were millions, each as innocent as his daughter, and millions more children in hiding even today from fear, oppression, and bigotry. But her life's work, however short, isn't just assessed by her sacrifice. The actual Anne Frank, the chatty, impish, scholarly, slightly spoiled daughter, is author of one of the most quoted and affecting passages of the 20th century. Winston Churchill, who wrote several of the others, called her phrasing technically sublime, morally impeccable. To hear her words now, taken from her diary entry of Saturday, July 15, 1944, is once again to marvel, to wince, and to wonder, what if there were just a few more people like her living in the world? The first words of that passage are read by 17-year-old Irena Milic, who lives in Sarajevo.
It's really a wonder that I haven't dropped all my ideals, because they seem so absurd and impossible to carry out. yet I keep them, because in spite of everything, I still believe that people are really good at heart. I simply can't build up my hopes on a foundation consisting of confusion, misery, and death. I see the world gradually being turned into a wilderness. I hear the ever-approaching thunder, which will destroy us too. I can feel the sufferings of millions,
and yet, if I look up into the heavens, I think that it will all come right, that this cruelty too will end,
and that peace and tranquility will return again. In the meantime, I must uphold my ideals, for perhaps the time will come when I shall be able to carry them out. Yours, Anne.
I think that it's kind of ironic that she says that she hopes that she goes on living long after she dies. And she says that in her diary, which is what keeps her voice alive, like 50 years later.
I feel the same way that you feel. I feel as though she can never die. She will always be there. If it's not with me, it's with someone else.
In the meantime, I must uphold my ideals, for perhaps the time will come when I shall be able to carry them out. Yours, Anne.
Our story was produced by Alice Winkler, production assistants from Roy Hodges and Deborah Schifrin. Reading from Anne Frank's diary and speaking with us were Emily McKnight and Luke Healy in Ames, Iowa, Izetta Mobley, Julia Hastings Black, Sarah Nicholas, Tiana Jenkins, and Richard Jones of Children's Express, Leah Siegel in Washington, D.C., and Irina Milich in Sarajevo. Our thanks also to Julia Hayball of the British Broadcasting Corporation in London and to David Baranow of the War Documentation Board of the Netherlands. This is NPR's Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon.